Good morning. Welcome to Radioactivity. I'm Rob Lori. Today, we'll hear from another of the candidates running for the District 15 congressional seat. We'll also hear from an expert on fascism and what he thinks is happening now in the U.S. And how well is President Trump doing with voters who voted against Hillary Clinton in 2016? We'll talk about that and open up the phone lines during the next hour. First, one listener comment about yesterday's news that the White House is now diverting some COVID-19 data away from the CDC and to a private company. We heard a bit about this on the NPR News just a moment ago. Here's what one listener had to say.
This is Catherine from Belgrade. I'm calling because I'm deeply, deeply disturbed about the change in the reporting of the data, the fact that they're going to bypass the CDC. We don't know where this data is going to go. And I feel like it's just a move by the Trump administration to hide the results. Remember, he said that he thought there was too much testing and that he wanted to slow it down. Well, he wasn't able to do that. So now what he's going to do is he's going to hide the information. So I was wondering, maybe you could look into what kind of data is going to be concealed once this gets reported, once the hospitals stop reporting to the CDC. That is, are the health departments going to have to report to Washington as well? Where are the websites going to get their data? You know, there's a number of websites that have very interesting graphs and data, and I was wondering how accurate that's going to be from now on.
Well, that was a listener comment that came in after yesterday's program. You're listening to WMNF in Tampa, 88.5 FM. First up today, another of our interviews with candidates for the Congressional District 15 seat, which includes portions of eastern Hillsborough County, Polk County, and Lake County, and the communities of Lakeland, Temple Terrace, Brandon, Plant City, and Riverview. We've already heard from two of the three Democratic candidates. Already we've heard from Adam Hattersley and Alan Cohn. Today we'll hear from Jesse Philippe. On his website, Jesse Philippe describes himself as born in North Miami to a single Haitian mother who could not afford to raise him or his brothers on her own. He grew up seeing his mother working double shifts to make ends meet. When he was 19 years old, he joined the Marines and soon after deployed to Iraq. He says he came back a changed man after 6 years of service and a tour in Iraq, and he had witnessed injustice, real poverty, and the lack of fundamental human rights. He came back with the idea that he needed to do more for the people around him. We're going to hear Jesse Philippe right now on WMNF. Jesse Philippe, welcome to WMNF. Good to have you here.
It's great to be here. Thank you for giving me an opportunity to speak. I look forward to the questions.
So why do you want the job? Why do you want to be in Congress?
Well, for me, I felt there was a lack of local focus in our U.S. Congress. I felt as if a lot of middle class was being kind of ignored in the Congress. So I decided that I spent a lot of my life in public service working in different areas like Department of Revenue, where I saw a lot of families struggling. So for me, I wanted to make sure that we had a Congress that represented common sense solutions for the average middle class family.
President Trump won the district by 10 points. So what makes you think that a Democrat can win?
I think a Democrat can win because what's been happening is just in our district particularly, there's a lot of people who haven't been heard. And I believe that those people are hearing it right now, especially our Northwest Lakeland area. They want to get very active this year, and I think that's going to be the minority group that's going to be able to turn over that 10 points and help us. When
let's talk about health care for a moment. We have the Affordable Care Act. What would you do to improve health access in the U.S.? Tens of millions of people are not covered by health insurance here in the U.S. 3 million Floridians have no health insurance. Would you improve Obamacare? Would you repeal it, as President Trump has said? What would you do?
What I would do is, essentially, I'm the only candidate who has a plan where I build on the existing VA system, open it up to working families, and give them public option access to health care. So if they make less than $30,000 a year, they will have access to the VA to get all the preventive care. And I believe that's the next step of health care. That's going to be in addition to what we already currently have, which is private insurance and Obamacare.
Let me just follow up on that. I know you're a veteran, but would veterans resent having civilians in the VA?
Well, veterans, they spend their life of service and they serve Americans. And, you know, I don't believe that should be resentful. I believe that it should be the next step forward for the country. I believe that we have a VA system that needs some help and needs to get better. And I believe that this will provide veterans more jobs when they get out of the military service, when they can quickly go into the VA to help deal with the increased demand of having working families in the system now.
One more question about healthcare. What do you think of the Canadian system where they have single-payer healthcare that's provided by the provinces?
I think that's a great step in terms of providing healthcare. Socialized medicine, but I believe that people still want, you know, the option to choose, you know, the healthcare system, and I don't think that's a great system for America. I think the system for America is to make sure that we give people options and choices, and for people who can't afford healthcare, there's something there for them. But people who can have whatever health they desire.
Our guest is Jesse Philippe. He is running for the Democratic nomination for Congressional District 15. That district includes parts of Eastern Hillsborough County and Polk County and Lake County, Brandon, Plant City, and Bartow and Claremont, I think, are in this district. And you're listening to WMNF in Tampa. So the federal minimum wage right now is $7.25 an hour. The minimum wage has continually lost buying power since 1968. What's a fair minimum wage that Congress should set for the country?
I believe that the minimum wage should be set at $15 an hour. And going forward, I believe that there should be a 10-year review to make sure that our minimum wage is falling in line with inflation. Kind of the big divide that's happening in America is the fact that our minimum wage doesn't reflect the inflation rate. So $7 an hour would have been a great thing 20 years ago, doesn't reflect now. Everything is going up in costs. Like I said, alluded to earlier, healthcare is going up in costs. We have, you know, groceries, loaf of bread are all going up in cost, so we need to make sure that our minimum wage is set for the standard that the standard of living for most people. And I believe that we should set it right now at 15 and then review it every couple of years to make sure that we're staying in line with our inflation rate.
What do you think of the Black Lives Matter movement?
I believe that, for me, the Black Lives Matter movement is a movement that talks about a group of people who've been disenfranchised and haven't been heard in a community. I believe that it's people who've dealt with certain bad police officers and misconduct in the police force for a very long time. I mean, this is not a new movement. This has been happening for a very long time in America. So I think that right now it's a light being shed on it, and we need to come up with common sense plans to help those group of people who are affected most by police brutality.
What could Congress do to move the country toward equality for all and to lower the amount of police brutality in the country? What role does Congress have?
Well, the role that Congress plays is to make sure that they're leaders. I believe that leadership comes from action. The recent bill that was passed by the U.S. House shows leadership, and it shows that there's a call to action that's being done. And also what they can really do is just get, you know, congressmen are very influential with their local politicians and their local county sheriffs, and they can use that influence to make sure that they have, you know, they bring in more body cams, they bring in more civilian review boards, and we can have that going across America just by using our leadership and influence to make sure that we get the local officials on board with being more transparent in our criminal justice system.
Now, some of the people that are protesting police brutality are concerned about the militarization of local police departments under the Pentagon's 1033 program since 1997. At least $7 billion in surplus military equipment, everything from office supplies to armored vehicles to grenade launchers, have been given to local police and law enforcement agencies. What do you think of the 1033 program?
I think that I served in the military, so for me, I got to see it firsthand how powerful militarized weapon is. And for me, I don't believe that that belongs on streets. I believe that we need to get our police force back into the community business. And the community business is making sure that they engage with the community. We do not need to have militarized weapons, armed tanks, you know, assault rifles on the roads to protect the average American citizen. Because the average American citizen, they just want to make sure that they have a safe place, you know, to be. They want to be safe and they want to feel safe. And I don't believe that military weapons actually helps that. I believe that it puts fear in certain groups, in certain communities. And I believe that we need to move away from demilitarizing. So I'm not a real big fan of the program, and I think we need to revisit that to make sure we put limits and maybe even stop it.
We already have some regulations on guns and ammunition, but some people are calling for more. Do you support any further regulations on the sales of guns or ammunition in the country?
I believe in a ban on assault weapons. I don't believe in a ban on all weapons. I believe that the Second Amendment is live and true, and it should be, if you want to purchase weapons, you should have the ability to. I don't believe assault weapons are one of those type of weapons. I'm for banning assault weapons because I feel as if that's not a weapon of that you need to protect yourself. I feel like that goes beyond those kind of use, and I believe that I 100% believe in 100% ban on assault weapons.
Our guest is Jesse Philippe. He's running for Congress. He's one of three Democrats vying for the Democratic nomination for Congressional District 15. That includes parts of eastern Hillsborough County and also parts of Polk County and Lake County. And this is WMNF 88.5 FM. How well do you think President Trump has responded to the outbreak of COVID-19?
I believe that there has been a failure of leadership at the presidential level. I believe that one of the things that we ask of our leaders is to make sure that they provide strength when everyone else is feeling weak. And I feel as if his leadership hasn't provided that strength, that his leadership is providing weakness, and it's making us more afraid. It's allowing other leaders to make poor decisions. For example, what's happening in our state, where we just reported the highest case of COVID-19 cases because we decided we wanted to reopen faster than what was recommended by doctors. I believe that leadership always sets the tone on how the country goes, and I believe that his leadership in this particular moment was not what we needed as a country.
The Social Security Administration says that among elderly Social Security beneficiaries, 21% of married couples, 45% of unmarried persons rely on Social Security for 90% or more of their income. As we see pension plans disappear across the country, more people are working part-time and for the gig economy. Social Security is becoming the income of last resort for more and more seniors. Some politicians have tried to privatize Social Security. Some have called for increasing benefits. What's your approach to Social Security?
I believe in increasing our Social Security. I believe that our Social Security has been, you know, it's what I said earlier in terms of a $15 minimum wage. It hasn't been able to catch up with inflation. I mean, the average person right now lives on $1,200 on Social Security, and it's not sustainable. I mean, we're running out of Social Security by the year 2034. Those are two big issues. The fact that there's not enough funding currently to provide for our seniors who rely on it, and second of all, that it's going to run out. The first thing we have to do is put limitations on who can pull out from Social Security, and we also have to put more funding into it so that we can increase the funding up to at least $1,400 to $1,500 for the average senior can live. And I don't think that's enough, but we have to start by understanding that it's a system that people do rely on, and it's a system that as we move over to a more technology geared economy, that more and more people, more and more seniors are not going to be able to work in that economy, and we have to understand that, and we have to make sure that we stand by them, just like in Social Security and this COVID-19 crisis.
So right now, if someone works for a wage or a salary, as Warren Buffett has famously pointed out, that person pays taxes at a higher rate than if you derive your income from investing. do billionaires and profitable corporations pay their fair share of taxes? And if they don't, what would you do to make sure that they do?
Well, I believe we have to rewrite the tax code. I mean, the tax code that was just passed initially was really in favor of people who are wealthy. We need to move over to a wealth tax. I believe that, consumption tax, and make sure that we keep, you know, the people who are making, you know, excess spending and spending a lot of money to, you know, keep them accountable and to make sure that they are paying their fair share. And I believe the best way to do that is by doing a consumption tax. And that's the best way that we will help, will hold, you know, people who have, you know, exorbitant amount of means to a standard where they're actually contributing to our society.
Do you think that President Trump is fit for office?
I don't know President Trump on a personal level. What I do know is leadership. You know, I've been in the Marine Corps for 6 years. I've, you know, worked in the Department of Revenue. I've seen, and I worked also in private corporations. I've seen leadership. I believe, like, his leadership skills and his leadership style, it's not what's needed for the country. And from my perspective, I don't believe that he should be our president because of that.
Well, we're talking with Jesse Philippe, who's one of three Democrats running for the district, Congressional District 15 Democratic nomination, and they'll face a Republican in the November race. The primary is August 18th, and this is WMNF 88.5 FM. Congress has the power to vote whether or not to authorize the president to go to war, and the U.S. is involved militarily in many parts of the world right now. We still have troops in Afghanistan and Iraq and other countries. Have we been too quick to get involved militarily in other countries, or are we using the military in the correct way?
I think, the first thing that we have to understand that people have to be safe. And our military provides that. And we've, you know, I state we because I've served. We've done that. For every time the bell is rung for us to step in, we've provided for that safety. We have to understand that we are in a new war front. The war is not going to be fought in a traditional sense. We're going to be moving towards cyber. We're going to be moving towards more high-speed military equipment. So we need to change our gears and change the way we see our military. Our military, you know, needs to be moved in a direction where it's leaning forward. And I believe that cyber defense, spending money in that department versus spending money into more, you know, rifles, more equipment is not necessarily how we use that. And the reason why I say this is because the conflicts that are going to be happening in the next couple of years are not going to be, you know, traditional combat fighting. It's going to be more into cyber defense. So I believe in providing more funding for our military in cyber defense areas and areas of technology and removing some of the money spent on traditional warfare, because I believe that our government has moved too quickly into traditional warfare many, many times and didn't really do an adequate assessment of the situation, and it's caused us more and more harm, such as the Iraq War, for example, which is our longest running war of all time. So I believe that we should invest heavily in cyber defense because that is our new war. And I believe that we should move away from the old military mindset of traditional warfare to actually solving people problems. We need to solve people problems in a way where it's more diplomatic versus more military.
Do you think China or Iran present a military threat to the U.S.?
I believe China does and Iran does. But like I said earlier, it's not a military threat in the traditional sense. It's not the military threat where we are scared of being of weapons or anything like that. It's on the military front of cyber defense. I believe that China and Iran both engages in cyber warfare with America, and it causes much confusion and dismay to a lot of our citizens in America. And I believe that that is the next war. I believe that we need to make sure we gear up for that war and understand that, now I'm not even going to say China and Iran, but also Russia, and make sure that we're properly defending Americans in the cyberspace.
Do you support the Green New Deal?
Yes, I do support the Green New Deal. I believe that the Green New Deal brings us forward. I believe that when Dwight D. Eisenhower decided to build our infrastructure, which is a high-speed railroad, high-speed system throughout America, he had a forward-leaning vision of making sure that the military had access to all of America. I believe the Green New Deal is a forward-leaning position on how we can keep our energy clean and how we can make sure that we have leave a country for our children to breathe fresh air and to take care of their earth. The one thing that I believe that the reason why I love the Green New Deal is because I myself have an infrastructure plan that's kind of based on the Green New Deal. My infrastructure plan talks about investing in high-speed rails. It talks about investing in more electric vehicles, even giving tax credits to the average American so they can afford electrical vehicles. I believe that's the way we need to move forward. And I believe that the Green New Deal is that first kind of blueprint that we can use to move forward.
Well, this next question is sort of related to what you just said. On most days, Interstate 4 in your district, if you're elected to Congress, Interstate 4 mm-hmm. is one long traffic jam. How would you improve the ability to get from Tampa to Orlando and back? What would you do for Interstate 4 to improve that part of the transportation network?
I said earlier, it's a high-speed rail. I believe that we could connect Pinellas, Hillsborough, Polk County, which are a majority of my district, through a high-speed rail system that connects all three. I believe that that's the best way to make sure that we stay more eco-friendly and more green, and also we bring in more people to our economy. The problem that we have right now in our district is the fact that it takes someone 45 minutes to get to one end of the district to the next. That shouldn't be the case. We have three great cities, Lakeland, Brandon, you know, Tampa, that can all be connected with just one high-speed rail. And I think that that's how we remove the congestion in the I-4 corridor and we move it into more practical means and making sure that people can move forward, but it doesn't have to just only be a vehicle. We can also take train, a high-speed rail train, to get to where we need to go to throughout the city.
Now, because we've got a little bit of extra time, here's a question I wasn't able to ask the other candidates. College costs are a big part of the expense of many people's lives. It's one of the tickets into the middle class for especially people who are trapped in poverty. What would you do about the high cost of college in the U.S.?
For me, I've created a plan where we incentivize people who decide to go into the public sector. So it's called the 444 plan. So you spend 4 years in college, you spend 4 years in the public sector, we will forgive you for 4 years of schooling, student loan debt. I believe that student loan debt is crippling our country, and if we don't find a way to tackle it, that's going to be an issue for the next generation. It's an issue for this generation, but even worse for the next generation, the way that the cost of tuition has gone up and it's going to continue to rise. I think that we incentivize people to go into the public sector, make sure that we have more prosecutors, more public defenders, and make sure we have more public service workers working in the tax revenues and different public sector jobs. While we do that, we'll include diversity because more people will go to school because they're not fearful of the debt they're going to incur to go to school, but they also know that when they get out, they're going to have a job. And I believe that's going to bring more diversity, bring more equality into our system, and it's going to allow people to get started, you know, buy houses, you know, start their families, and not have to wait 4 or 5 years before they can actually make a difference.
Jesse Philippe, those are all my questions. If people want to get in touch with your campaign or help out or find out more, what's the best way to get in touch with you?
The best way to get in touch with me is jessephilippe.com. It's jessephilippe.com. There's a section there where you can put your information in, and then our team usually reaches out to you. And we also have a phone number, which is also on the website. You can call us if you have any questions. Like a lot of the plans that I stated today are on the website, but more people like more detail. So if you call us, we will actually provide you a white paper with the full details of our plans. So that's how you can contact me, jessephili.com, JessePhilippe.
Jesse Philippe, thanks a lot for coming on WMNF. Great to have you here.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate it, and I'm really humbled you gave me this opportunity to speak today. Thank you.
Well, that was another in our series of interviews with the candidates. This is an interview with Jesse Philippe, a candidate for the Congressional District 15, which includes portions of Hillsborough County, portions of Polk County, and portions of Lake County. He'll be on the ballot August 18th, along with two other Democratic rivals, whom we heard from earlier, Adam Hattersley and Alan Cohn. And you're listening to WMNF in Tampa. Thanks for tuning in. If you want to comment about anything you've heard here so far, you're always welcome to email the studio. The address is dj@wmnf.org. Well, next we'll hear from a Yale scholar who's concerned about the state of American democracy. This interview comes to us from the PBS program Amanpour and Company. It is carried on the local PBS station. Here is Christian Amanpour to introduce the topic.
Yale University's Timothy Snyder is a historian and author, devoting much of his career to understanding the rise of tyranny in different parts of the world. And he sat down with our contributor, Anna Cabrera, to discuss his concerns about the trend taking root in the United States.
You have devoted so much of your studying, your teaching, your writings to understanding the rise of fascism and tyranny in different parts of the world. You're sounding the alarm about what you are seeing here in the U.S. right now. How concerned are you about America's democracy?
I think I'm the right amount of concerned. When America's democracy was founded in the late 18th century by people we revere, it wasn't founded on the idea that Americans are a special people. It was founded on the idea that tyranny is easy and democracy and republics are hard. The whole system was set up to prevent one man or one party from accumulating all the power. That system has been tested for more than 200 years. It's being seriously tested now. But I think I'm the right amount of worried, because everybody should be worried. To be a citizen in a democracy is to understand that you have to take a certain amount of risk yourself. The system doesn't sustain itself on its own.
Can you talk about what it is that concerns you the most?
Absolutely. Well, in the last few weeks, as we've watched impeachment and the impeachment trial unfold, we've seen challenges to the basic founding documents of our country. The whole idea of the Declaration of Independence is that no man is above the law. The reason why independence was declared by the colonies was that King George was breaking established rules, established contracts. But the underlying principle was that everyone should be governed by the law. Mr. Trump's defense in the impeachment trial was precisely that he is above the law, that whatever he says is the law, that we should wait and see what he says and then adapt the law to that. That is precisely what tyrants over the centuries and authoritarians in the last century have always said. Our second basic founding document, the Constitution, is basically a design how to prevent someone from becoming a tyrant. It assumes that if we have three parts of the government, they will balance each other. Mm-hmm. But what we saw unfold in the impeachment trial was the opposite. The Congress gave way, and then Justice Roberts also gave way. So that at the end of it, we have a much, much stronger executive claiming nearly absolute power, which is something that the founders precisely were trying to prevent.
You said Justice Roberts gave way. How did he give way?
Well, I mean, I've been doing an old-fashioned thing, which is actually reading the text of the Constitution. And according to the Constitution, the Chief Justice presides. That is to say, he's in charge. The senators are meant to be jurors. What Chief Justice Roberts allowed to happen was that the jurors decided that they could do things like say how they're going to vote in advance, that the jurors could decide to do things like not listen to evidence, that the jurors could decide basically the shape of a trial. If you're in a small claims court, or if you're in a divorce court, or if you're in any kind of court in the United States, those kinds of principles where the judge just gives up would be unthinkable. So basically what we saw was a trial that wasn't a trial. And so both in the form and in the outcome, the Supreme Court ends up being marginalized and not just the Congress.
Trump has been impeached, he's been acquitted, and since all of that, he's gone on to fire two of the witnesses who testified during the impeachment process, one of them being Lieutenant Colonel Alexander Vindman, a Purple Heart recipient, a military veteran, and he, you'll recall, testified during the House impeachment process that he felt it was his duty to respond to a subpoena, to speak the truth. And his lawyer said in a statement, the truth has now cost Lieutenant Colonel Alexander Vindman his job, his career, and his privacy. He did what any member of our military is charged with doing every day. He followed orders, he obeyed his oath, and he served his country, even when doing so was fraught with danger and personal peril. And for that, the most powerful man in the world, buoyed by the silent, the pliable, and the complicit, has decided to exact revenge. And Tim, the president didn't even try to suggest this was anything other than revenge. And now Trump is saying the military should look into potentially disciplining Lieutenant Colonel Alexander Vindman. What does this tell you?
Well, it tells me three things. I mean, personally about Mr. Trump, it tells me that his desire to protect himself, his ego, his appearance, his sense of being right is bottomless. Because if there's anything that you should hold back from doing, it's from punishing someone like Lieutenant Colonel Vindman. The second thing it tells me, rather reminds me, is how important the lines of authority actually are, even within the executive branch. We have never had a system where the president instructs the military what rules should be followed in terms of military justice. So even within the executive branch, there are some lines that are very important. The third thing, though, that it calls up to me is a memory of what purges are like, because that, of course, is what is happening. People who refuse to toe the line, a line of fiction, a line which said that Ukraine plotted against the United States and not Russia, a line that said a server was in Ukraine, which has never been the case, a line which said that Ukraine was corrupting us when we were trying to corrupt Ukraine, in fact, under the Trump administration, a line which was false, a set of statements which were clearly false and which Republican senators also know to be false, that you don't follow a line like that and then get purged. That's what happens in authoritarian systems, or rather in totalitarian systems.
And just add in what else is playing out this past week within the Justice Department and in the Roger Stone case, in which we now have four prosecutors who are part of that case who have withdrawn from that case. Two of them resigned from their office altogether after they were undercut. After giving their sentencing recommendation, they were undercut by senior members of the DOJ after the president publicly complained about the sentencing that they were recommending. In fact, you know, he's a friend of Roger Stone, and he clearly showed how he felt the outcome was unfair. That was according to him. What implications could this have?
Well, there are two major ones. I mean, one that we're already beginning to forget is just how deep and long-lasting the consequences are when a foreign power plays around with American elections. So people like Roger Stone, or for that matter, Mr. Trump, who is both involved and is a beneficiary, are naturally going to be affected by the fact that a foreign power was involved. The fact that Russia mattered in 2016, that Mr. Stone helped Russia to matter in 2016, that Mr. Trump did as well, affects what they do in 2020 and for the rest of their lives. So this is one more argument for trying to make our democracy sovereign rather than something which is open to international money and international influence. But the second and even more important implication is that this is a direct attack on the rule of law. The basic idea of our whole legal tradition is that law comes before the individual person. And the more power you have, the more you have to respect that principle. If you're in Mr. Trump's position, what he's done is the very last thing that he ought to be doing. And this is a basic principle of our system. Without the rule of law, nothing else is possible, including freedom, including all the other values which people, Republican, Democrat, Independent, or whatever they might be, say are important.
What role does the media play? Because we obviously help determine what is news, and then we amplify that to make sure the information gets out to the public. Are we partially to blame, and what do we do about that?
I think that the basic problem we have with the media is that we don't have enough media that actually search for, hunt down, create, and record facts. What we don't have are enough reporters. We don't have people covering local news. We don't have enough independent editorial boards on local newspapers who would be giving their own independent opinion about impeachment that might be different from opinions coming out of New York or Washington, or out of the two political parties. We don't have enough creation of enough new material anymore. So we all get locked down in these emotional, polarizing debates where everything seems obvious immediately. So, I mean, the big media has made some mistakes, of course. Treating everything as about personality makes things easier on authoritarians. But our big problem with the media is that we just don't have enough facts.
Well, and at this point, it also feels like the facts and the truth doesn't seem to matter. It doesn't break through. You look at, you know, the Washington Post fact checker, which shows the president has said more than 16,000 false or misleading statements since he's been in office. And yet, you know, the president continues to present what it is he wants people to believe. And he repeats it over and over and over again. And his supporters specifically buy it. Why is that?
Since people first thought up democracy, we knew it would be hard because human beings naturally want to hear what they want to hear. And Mr. Trump is very good at telling people what they want to hear. And the internet is basically a device for finding out what you want to hear and giving it to you. So this is the same challenge that we've always had in a new form. And what it means is that you can't be cynical. You can't give up on the truth. You can't give up on facts. You have to say, I'm on the side of facts, because facts give us a chance to have deliberative democracy, give us a chance to have law, gives us a chance to have decency, and for that matter, prosperity. Because one of the things that I think the people who don't care about facts aren't thinking about is that ultimately, not just democracy, but functioning markets depend upon factuality. And if we get rid of it completely, we're going to have not only authoritarianism, but our prosperity will very soon be at risk as well.
The president communicates with a lot of slogans and mantras and things that are easy to remember. He gives his supporters something to rally around, right? Like make America great, like America first. You say this is a form of politics of eternity, which started in Russia. Explain.
Okay, well, with the slogans, it goes way back. I mean, the idea of a slogan like lock her up or drain the swamp is to get people rallied so that they think we're in, they're out, we're the real nation, the other people are not the real nation, they're corrupt, whatever it might be. That's older than Russia. That goes back to fascism and other kinds of authoritarianism. By politics of eternity, I mean the kind of politics which we see very much in the 21st century, where not much policy actually gets made. If you look at Trump's 4 years, there's basically zero policy in the sense of big laws that could affect people's lives. The one big law is a tax cut for corporations and the rich, and that's not really policy. That's just gravity. That's what happens when you do nothing. But politics of eternity is teaching people that politics is not about changing the world. Politics is just about characterizing the world. We're good, they're bad, we're in, they're out. And we know this because we say it to ourselves with these persuasive and appealing slogans over and over and over again.
What do you think America's adversaries, people like Putin, are thinking as they're witnessing what's happening right now in America?
We are helping Putin's system last, because the whole justification for Mr. Putin's system in Russia is that, sure, things in Russia are corrupt, sure, we're an oligarchy, sure, the media lied to you all the time, but look at other countries, it's just the same. Basically, what's happened in the US in the last 3 years confirms this. Our institutions, unfortunately, have become more and more like the caricature that the Russian media portrays them as being. The impeachment trial is a very good example. You have the solemn picture of Justice Roberts talking about this being the supreme deliberative body in the world, which is obviously, in the circumstances, a joke, right? And making our institutions a joke is exactly what helps authoritarians like Mr. Putin survive. If there's no example of things going better, it makes their life much, much easier. I mean, a big sad thing which is happening is that there is no longer an American example. The American example has always been imperfect in many ways, but there is now no longer an American example that dissidents in China or oppositionists in Hong Kong or journalists in Russia or Poland or Hungary or wherever could point to, thanks to Mr. Trump.
We know that President Putin and Russia launched a disinformation campaign to interfere in the 2016 election here in the United States. And the FBI director, Christopher Wray, just recently said they're already seeing signs of Russia trying to interfere in the upcoming election. But this time, it's not just Russia. And according to a recent investigative report in The Atlantic, journalist McKay Coppins writes that the Trump campaign and some of his domestic allies, partisan media, outside political groups, have begun to, quote, adopt the same tactics of information warfare that have kept the world's demagogues and strongmen in power. What do you think we should be bracing for?
Well, this is what I was worried about way back in 2016 when I wrote On Tyranny and Road to Unfreedom. What Russia does is not particular to Russia. What Russia does is how an oligarchy with a good understanding of the media stays in power. What you do is you figure out what people want to hear, not just by a leader's instinct, but by way of technical tools, which can, thanks to Facebook and Google, you can actually learn. And then you target your messages to them. And you don't care that your messages are lies. In fact, it's better if your messages are lies, because you want people to think that there's not really any truth and to just accept the story which sounds better. So what we can expect is, I think, a battle between what I think are the underlying political values. I don't think it's about classes. I think the underlying political values now are truth and falsehood. Truth as the basis for policy, falsehood as the basis for enmity. I think that's some variant of that is the real clash that's going on, which doesn't mean that, you know, that somebody is always good and somebody's always bad. I just think that's fundamentally the issue. The fundamental question is, can you win a campaign proposing policy based on facts against someone whose basic idea is just to stir the pot with the most advanced technical tools possible and to rile people up? That's not an American dilemma now. That's now a world dilemma. That's everywhere. We're unfortunately normal and no better than anybody else. And if we face that fact and see what the challenge is, I still think we have a chance.
What do you see as the role of social media companies then to prevent some of that disinformation from getting through?
Yeah, the social media companies have a big problem with the idea of responsibility. I mean, what they think freedom is the freedom of a few individuals to do very well. But there's a big, what the economists call externality. There's a big cost, which is that people's average levels of knowledge are declining, and people's ability to engage with the world around them in various ways is also in decline. I think there has to be a rethink of social media, just as there was a rethink of the printing press and a rethink of radio and of every major new communications technology, where responsibility in some form has to be injected back into the system. I think it's ludicrous for Facebook to present itself as just passing on what other people do. What Facebook does is it amplifies the authoritarian habit of looking for the emotion of fear. That's what it does. That's its design model. It looks for what makes you anxious and fearful and makes you feel tribal and childish, right? It looks for that. It's a tool that does that. That's it. That's by design. So it has an inbuilt authoritarian bent. If it wants to be neutral, it has to pull away from being authoritarian and make some changes to itself which support factuality, which could certainly be done. We know some of the ways to do that. But I mean, for me, the key word is responsibility. Whether you're talking about foreign actors like Russia or domestic actors, the platforms with their guise of just being neutral are what make it all possible. Without the platforms, this couldn't happen.
As you know, there are a lot of Americans who don't just accept the status quo. They're very engaged in democracy and this election that's upcoming. I see a lot of hashtag resist online and people calling themselves the resistance. In this way, is it a productive use of their advocacy for American democracy, or do you feel like it's misguided?
I think the word resist is good because it calls attention to the fact that what's happening isn't just a change of policy, but a change of regime. We are living through a slow regime change in the U.S. towards some kind of more authoritarian oligarchy. And so regardless of our positions on individual policies or statements of the president, we can say, I would like to resist that general tendency. I don't want authoritarianism. I want oligarchy. That's a start. But of course, in the end, it's more important to know what you're for, and to be able to say what you're for. I'm for, you know, this kind of education in the classroom. I'm for freedom of speech for humans, but not for digital beings who don't have souls. I'm for economic inequality, which gives people a chance to imagine a better future. I'm for a system where everybody actually does have one vote and there's no voter suppression and so on and so forth. So I think the idea of resistance is fine because it calls attention to the drama of the moment, and it is a dramatic moment. But at the end of the day, you also have to have a notion of what liberty and what law and what these values actually look like, so that you're not just letting the people who are changing the regime in the wrong way call the shots and define the concepts.
Professor Timothy Snyder, I really, really appreciate this conversation. Thank you so much.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you.
That was Yale University's Timothy Snyder, an historian who teaches at Yale. His books include On Tyranny and Road to Unfreedom, and he was being interviewed by Anna Cabrera on the PBS program Christian Amanpour and Company. Well, this is WMNF in Tampa, 88.5 FM. If you've got a comment about anything you've heard here so far, you're welcome to email the studio. The address is dj@wmnf.org. And this is Radioactivity. Finally today, before we go to the phones, independent voters likely hold the key to the upcoming presidential election. A new survey finds that about 13% of Obama 2012 voters chose Donald Trump in 2016, and 4% of Clinton support came from people who voted for Mitt Romney in 2012. That's millions of voters in play, neither reliably Democratic nor reliably Republican. New group of people being identified as new Biden voters has emerged. They were not committed to Biden 2 months ago, and now they say they'll vote for Biden, and found that the former vice president is attracting support from the very kind of voters who denied Clinton the job in 2016. One such voter who voted against Hillary Clinton in 2016 has posted this video online, which has received more than 5 million views, about how he plans to vote this November.
Hi, my name is Jeffrey Farmer. I'm from Mendon, Massachusetts. And I don't even know why I'm doing this stupid thing, because this is not what I do. I don't do social media or anything. But I can't take this anymore. This guy, he's like a Tasmanian devil. He just throws bombs everywhere. People can't even keep up with the stuff that he's saying now. And putting my children at friggin' risk going to school, the teachers putting them at risk. I want them to go to school. I want the economy to be great and everything. We all want that. I'm sick. I have an immunodeficiency. I have multiple autoimmune diseases, and I've been doing everything right. We're all supposed to be doing right. This guy couldn't lead freaking his way out of a freaking wet paper bag. I'm voting for Joe Biden. The reason I voted for Trump last time was because I could not stand Hillary Clinton. I don't get it. I don't understand, but if this guy, another 4 years, I can't do it. I can't do any more time with this guy. I feel like I'm in friggin' prison. It's brutal. And I've never been this way about any president. This guy should get the frick off Twitter. All he does is watch the goddamn news. Why don't you do your frickin' job, Donald Trump? Instead of frickin' whining and complaining about everything, everyone's out to get you. You know what, dude? Walk a mile in my shoes, and then you could freaking maybe have the right to freaking bitch about something. Dude, you are a goddamn sorry excuse for a freaking human being. Please, if you do not become president again, if we vote this guy back in again, I'm done. I can't do it anymore. Well, one more message for you, Trump. Shut the fuck up for once. For once. Why don't you admit you're f***ing wrong for once? And why don't you show some kind of empathy towards somebody other than yourself? Good night, Donald.
All right, so that video by Jeffrey Farmer in Massachusetts has received more than 5 million views. There are voters in play, and they have crossed party lines. In 2016, some voters who previously had voted Democratic for president then voted for Donald Trump, and a smaller group voted for Mitt Romney and then chose, about 4% chose to vote for Hillary Clinton. We're going to take some phone calls and read your emails. Our phone number is 813-239-9663. Our email address is dj@wmnf.org. So if you want to comment about anything you've heard here so far, you can email the studio or call us up, 813-239-9663. Carol writes this, thanks for the Timothy Snyder interview, one of the best interviews, concise questions, very clear answers, writes Carol. This news just came in an hour ago. Florida saw a record high number of deaths announced today, recording 156 people dead from coronavirus in the past 24 hours. The number passes the previous record high, which was recorded on Tuesday. The seven-day death average continued upward, moving from about 91 people per day to about 96 people dead per day. Since March, 4,782 people statewide have died from the coronavirus. The Tampa Bay area, with 72 deaths, was responsible for just under half of all the day's deaths, with a record high of 40 deaths announced out of Hillsborough County in the last 24 hours. Hospitalizations also hit a record high, increasing by 495 admissions, bringing the total increase in hospital treatment because of coronavirus to 20,154. So the COVID-19 numbers continue to rise. And again, our phone number is 813-239-9663. Our email address, dj@wmnf.org. Let's go to Jim in Tampa. Jim, what would you like to comment about?
Well, it's actually Tim in Tampa.
I'm sorry, Ken?
Yeah, no problem.
All right.
Tim in Tampa. I'm just wondering, the voter who called in, on the Facebook post, why would a person like that think this way now? What could possibly he have saw in Trump to make him vote that way? I mean, anybody, in my viewpoint, anybody with an inkling of common sense saw this guy was a con man. And this guy is a typical Trump voter who was conned, and now he's upset. So when I hear him come on posting that post, Facebook thing, I'm saying, what did you now that you didn't see then? It's amazing.
Yeah, he's not here to answer that, so I don't know.
I know.
I don't know how to explain it.
But I would hope a Trump voter who's out there, who's listening, please call in and tell me what you saw then that you don't see now that will make you not vote for this guy. That's what I want. I want to hear from them.
Okay, well, maybe they'll call in. Tim, thanks a lot. Nope, he hung up. Our phone number is 813-239-9663, and our email address is dj@wmnf.org. I just want to read this from CNN. Some COVID-19 hospital data has been removed from the CDC's website following the Trump administration's decision to reroute coronavirus information. So you can find that information on the CDC website. Karen in Dunedin writes this, I voted for Jill Stein of the Green Party, and I feel guilty that I contributed to this mess. I am voting for Joe, writes Karen in Dunedin. I would like to hear from some Trump voters, people that are going to vote for President Trump this fall. Kevin writes this, thanks for the Snyder interview. He summed up my feelings exactly. All right, thank you for that. And then Bill from Pinellas Park says, regarding the Jesse Philippe interview, he says, young men and women today give me a bit of hope for the future, the country, and the earth. I wish I lived in the area so I could vote for him, writes Jesse. Jesse, thank you for that. Mark in Brandon says, thank you for featuring the candidate interviews. It's been enlightening. You may have mentioned it, but do you know their ages? You know, I don't ask candidates' ages. I should. If I was working for a newspaper, certainly I would. I think that's something that you can find pretty easily online. But that may be a good question. Does that raise the issue of ageism if I ask people their age? I don't know. And again, if you want to email the studio, the address is dj@wmnf.org. The Surly Feminists are coming up next, and they'll be on the Midpoint program in 5 minutes. If you want to comment about today's show, please call us at 813-238-8001 and record your comment on extension 115. I'll play your comments back tomorrow morning at 11 o'clock. Stay tuned for the Surly Feminist. Thanks to Bill Grace for being our phone producer today. This is 88.5 FM, WMNF, Tampa, St. Petersburg, Sarasota, and Lakeland.